Welcome to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac, a show about how to break through obstacles that may be holding you back in life or business. And now your host of Breakthrough Thinking, certified master practitioner in neuro-linguistic programming, business consultant, and CPA, Dave Isaac.
Live from the 1010 Studios in Phoenix, Arizona, you are listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, the host of Breakthrough Thinking. And if it is the second Monday of every month, it must be Law Talk, sponsored by Reitenauer, Heighton & Lewis. And we are honored to have in studio Bob Hackett from Reitenauer, Heighton & Lewis. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Fine, Dave. How are you?
Oh, good. It sounds like you have a New York accent.
I do.
That's good. So
I'm originally from New York.
That is so cool. Do you miss it at all?
Sometimes. I have a lot of friends back there, but we prefer Arizona.
Well, yeah, Arizona's so nice. The weather, you can't beat the weather.
Well, we've raised our three kids here.
Oh, really? That used to be a TV show, My Three Sons. Did
yes.
you ever watch that?
I did.
Fred McMurray, remember?
That's right.
That was really cool. Now
you're dating yourself.
I know. People say that. We actually have a dating show called Match No Match as part of Breakthrough Thinking, and people say I date myself. Okay, different context. Okay, but I save on popcorn because I just get to buy it myself. Right, Kurt? All right, Kurt's really... And, of course, our great producer, Kurt, in the, what do you call that, the producer room or something? Yeah. Oh, the control room. That's what it's called. Anyway, you have an interesting name, Bob Hackett. Do you go by Bob or Robert?
Bob.
Okay. Isn't there a TV court thing called Judge Hackett?
I was unaware of that.
I think there is. Isn't there, Kurt? Judge Hackett? Okay. You never watch that stuff.
There's another Bob Hackett in town as a lawyer. All kinds of confusion about that.
Really? And I think there's a comedian. Isn't there a Bob Hackett comedian? Or
Buddy Hackett.
Oh, Buddy Hackett.
No
oh,
relation.
He was cool. Did you ever see him?
Yes. He lived in Englewood, and we did, too, in New Jersey.
Did you know him?
I'd never met him.
Oh.
But my wife met his wife at the beauty shop.
Is that right? He was hysterical. I think he passed away a couple years ago.
He did.
Is his wife still alive?
I don't know.
But he was absolutely hysterical. One of my favorite of all time comedians, no doubt about it. Anyway, well, let's get right to the topic at hand. Why don't you give us a brief background about you as an attorney? What do we got?
Well, I graduated in 1967 from Duke Law School, and I went back home, then New York, and practiced with Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. The firm at the time was about 125 lawyers. Now they're well over 500 international. But my practice there was corporate securities and banking regulatory work, and I continue to do that kind of work here.
Wow, that is such a specialized field, I believe, and it's very complex. I suspect things even changed after the Enron situation. Did it get tougher, and did you? How did that work out for you?
Well, I think there was higher scrutiny after Enron on securities offerings and companies that were playing fast and loose, and the Securities and Exchange Commission enforcement actions went way up, and Enron was a big problem for the SEC and the securities agencies. Basically, what we have are two levels of securities regulation. The goal is to protect the integrity of the capital markets and protect investors. So the first level is federal securities regulation, and there the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC is charged by Congress with administering the federal securities laws. The first notable Securities Act is the Securities Act of 1933, and that basically provides a requirement that non-exempt securities be registered with the SEC.
Now, how would you define non-exempt securities?
Non-exempt securities are securities that don't require registration. There may be other potential exemptions, but let me just describe
sure.
two that are key in our practice. The first is under the general rubric of private placements, and there SEC Regulation D. And so you file Form D with the SEC and with the states in which the offering will be made. And then the SEC will adopt a no-action position against the issuer. It's important to recognize the concept of accredited investors, and those are folks that have at least $1 million in net worth or at least $200,000 of income, $300,000 with spouse, for the last 2 years and an expectation of realization of reaching the same income level in the current year. Under the Dodd-Frank Act, which was passed about a year ago, in computing that $1 million net worth, you have to exclude the principal residence of the investor in computing the net worth test. Now, Arizona, interestingly, has not, the Arizona Securities Division of the Arizona Corporation Commission has not yet made that change regarding principal residence. If you have accredited investors, you can sell securities to an unlimited number of investors. If you're offering to non-accredited investors, then the disclosure must be equivalent to that required in what we call a Regulation A offering, if eligible, or in Part 1 of a registration statement, basically what would be required in a full-blown prospectus. And we limit the number of investors in where we're dealing with non-accredited investors.
So how would you define, is a non-accredited investor everyone else other than accredited investors? Is that how it works?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So that's how it works. Now, what's interesting, you know, as a CPA, we talked off there a little bit, and occasionally I'll have clients that want to raise money, and I think in this economy, probably everyone's trying to raise money. You see a lot of new businesses start. A Regulation D, well, before I ask you that, what words of wisdom would you give to people if they want to raise money? Because there's a lot of businesses that have no clue what they're getting into. And I suspect the first words of wisdom is call an SEC attorney. Am I right?
I think that's right. This is not a simple subject. You have to hire, in order to be safe, you have to hire the professionals.
Oh, yeah.
And those include an accounting firm. An investment banker is preferable.
Right.
And securities counsel. And have the accountants prepare the financial statements. The company should prepare a business plan with pro forma financial statements that are appropriately qualified. There shouldn't be any puffing language in the business plan, and you should attach risk factors and set forth the assumptions upon which the projections are based for the protection of the company and its control persons. If the reaction from those professionals is positive, then counsel ought to prepare the documents for the offering.
But one thing for sure they probably shouldn't do is just go out and start raising money.
No, that is not a good idea. We read every month or so about somebody who's gone out and offered securities without compliance under the Arizona Securities Act. So it's dangerous territory.
Let me go back for
a moment, Dave,
okay,
to the other exemption
from
registration that we often use in our private equity offerings, and that's the intrastate offering exemption under the 1933 Act. And that simply is an offering by the issuer to residents of the same state in which the issuer has its principal place of business. Now, the second prong of federal regulatory authority is the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Remember, I mentioned the Securities Act of 1933.
Yeah.
The 34 Act involves regulation of periodic reports by publicly held companies, and those are are known as a 10K, which is the annual report, 10Q, which are the quarterly reports, and 8K for specific events like bankruptcy.
Gotcha. Yeah.
The second area that the 34 Act focuses on is the anti-fraud provision. And their famous rule 10b-5, which prohibits misleading investors, basically. And then there's regulation in the 34 Act of proxy statements. And proxy statements are required when a transaction requires shareholder approval. Now, let me go. So the SEC's philosophy is focused on disclosure fairly presented. The other level of securities regulation is through the state securities commissions. So in Arizona, the securities division of the Arizona Corporation Commission is the regulator of securities. And Arizona is a merit review state, has a merit review state standard for the approval of securities. And the standard is fair, just, and equitable, unlike the SEC's orientation or philosophy, which is fair disclosure. And that plays out in a very different type of approach by the Securities Division. Then there are other state securities agencies for every state in which the offering will be made. And there again, the principal objective of the state regulators is to protect investors.
So if you're going to raise money or a company is going to raise money, not just in one state but many states, you actually have to know the state law of each state, right?
In which the offering is to be made.
Does that drive you nuts? I mean,
that can be a lot. It's part of
what you do.
What I do.
Yeah, that's incredible, though.
But
right?
That's one of the reasons why it's so complex.
Now, is there ever any conflicts or contradictions between federal and state or any of the states? And
no, the SEC doesn't tread on blue sky authority in Arizona, at least.
Yeah.
There are different philosophies, like I mentioned before, but in any event, it's pretty well recognized by the federal securities authorities that when you're offering securities in, say, Arizona and California, that the blue sky commissions in those states have to have their way with regard to state regulation.
That's interesting. Now, let me ask you this, just to clarify a couple things for the listeners. You said the SEC philosophy is focused on disclosure
fairly presented, yes.
And the standard in Arizona, at least, review state merit review state.
It's merit review, yes.
Fair, just, and equitable. What are the differences there? How would you describe it?
At least theoretically, the Securities Division can decide that even though the disclosure is there, that the offering is not fair, just, and equitable. And deny the registration. Now, that's very unusual.
That's a SEC you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about the Securities Division.
So the state of Arizona.
Of Arizona.
They could say, hey, this isn't fair. We don't care. That's our opinion. You're out.
Yes.
Wow. That is quite a difference, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, why would the SEC not have that also?
Because the philosophy of Congress when they passed the 33 Act was fair disclosure.
I gotcha.
The states, on the other hand, followed, and there are other merit review states than Arizona. Most of the states follow the disclosure philosophy expressed in the 33 Act and SEC regulations.
Well, when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Bob Hackett from Reitinger, Hyten and Lewis. And we're talking about really SEC securities regulation. Really interesting, especially if you're a business thinking about raising money. You better think twice and call an attorney. We'll be right back.
Reitinger, Hyten and Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, a private client practice. Reidenauer, Hynten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Law Talk, sponsored by Reidenauer, Hyten & Lewis. In studio guest, Bob Hackett, a securities attorney, we'll call you, because that's what you do. And this is complex stuff. I'll tell you, as a CPA, I'll get asked every so often about investing, raising money from investors. And I go, you got to talk to an attorney now. I have no clue. It's a very complex topic, but let's go back to a couple things. You talked about private placements. Regulation D requires, I guess, filing a Form D with SEC and the states in which the offering will be made. So describe what this Form D is for listeners that are thinking of raising money, or maybe they've already started and maybe they better stop, but that's up to a great attorney to advise them. So what's a Form D?
Well, I knew, Dave, that you would be interested in the subject of Form Ds because it's a sexy topic.
It is. It's very sexy. Kurt, is it? Yeah, he's raised it. It's D is starting initial with Dave, so that's why it is a sexy topic. Okay. I should play the Dave song now, but anyway, we'll do that later. That'll be a surprise. Form D.
So Form D should be filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission at or before the time of the commencement of the offering.
Which is very important, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What not to sidetrack, but it's related. What if, or I'll ask the question, and you can come back to it if you want to continue on this, what the Form D. But if someone's already started investing, is there a way to backtrack and unwind it without doing the Form? You know, if they say, whoops, we didn't know about that, they already raised some money, can you unwind it, or is that a problem?
Well, you can withdraw, but that will get a lot of attention at the Enforcement Division of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So you want to be sure to file Form D at or before the commencement of the offering.
Gotcha.
And the Form D is really a fairly simple document to prepare, as long as you know the information that's required. You have to indicate the issuer's identity. In other words, what entity is going to be offering and issuing the securities, and its principal place of business and contact information, so that if the SEC gets its nose out of joint, it knows who to contact. Related persons, those are folks who are involved in the organization of the company. An indication as to what industry is involved. Is it banking and financial services? Is it energy, healthcare, real estate, and so forth? And then the federal exemption claimed. And in this case, that would be usually Form D. But it could be the intrastate offering exemption, which I previously mentioned. And then the duration of the offering, the type of securities offered, Are these shares of common stock or are they preferred stock? Are there warrants, which are options to purchase securities of the issuer? Is this a business combination transaction? And then the compensation, the minimum investment, and sales compensation to say a licensed investment banker, which is going to offer the securities on behalf of the issuer, and then the offering and sales amounts, the total offering amount, the total amount sold, and item 14, the investors, are they all accredited, and then sales commissions and finder's fee expenses. So it's a uniform Form D for both the Securities and Exchange Commission and for most of the states, including Arizona. And again, you would file that Form D on or before the commencement of the offering.
Now, is it an automatic approval?
No, it's not.
What do they have to do?
It's very seldom that I have never had a Form D rejected over the many decades that I've practiced securities law. So it would be very unusual to have it rejected.
So when this says it's a no action position against the issuer once it's approved, what does that mean?
That means that you're operating within a safe harbor.
Gotcha. So if an investor tries to sue you for losses or whatever, they can't. Is that true?
They can if you have misstated the proposition, if you've misled the investors. But they can't if you file the Form D and comply with the other requirements of Reg D.
So that's very important, isn't it?
It's crucial.
Yeah, because it's like free protection in a way, right?
Well,
actually,
if you blow the exemption, the investors can require you to rescind the transaction and refund their capital plus interest. So it's not to be lightly ignored.
Yeah, I totally understand. Now, some listeners out there that want to start a business or in a business thinking of raising money, is there any particular advice you would give someone if they said, hey, should I go after accredited investors? Should I go after non-accredited investors? There's different rules. One, accredited is Regulation D. Non-accredited is Regulation A. There's probably differences in those two forms. So what would you tell someone?
It's much preferable to make an offering to accredited investors.
And that's because?
Because the disclosure requirements in the private placement memorandum are not as heavy. And heavy means more expensive.
Oh, there you go. I like that. Heavy fees. I've never heard of that. Heavy fees, but it's the same thing. Expensive fees, heavy fees. But that's the rules. I mean, if you're going to play the game, you better play by the rules, right?
Yes, indeed.
That makes sense to me.
Yes.
There's no doubt. So accredited investors, that means, I guess, do you have to know the investors, or can you just, once you have this Regulation D, this Form D, can you just send it out to, you know, get a mailing list and send it out to top
No, you don't
people?
Want to. You don't want to do that until you're sure that you know the answer to the question, are we dealing with accredited investors or not?
So how do you determine that? Are you get
when,
their financial statements,
when,
I suspect.
When you send out the offering documents, you have a questionnaire attached to the offering documents, and they require you to disclose your net worth, your income, and so forth. And on the basis of those two answers, you would then decide whether and under what circumstances you would prepare a private placement memorandum. Now, it's very important to recognize that even if you have all accredited investors, you want to be very careful about the disclosure that you provide. It has to be, it has to disclose all material facts. that might influence the judgment of the investor whether to invest, and attach risk factors and factors that that the company will have to overcome to be successful.
That's interesting. Now, do you, going back to the questionnaire on accredited investors, do you have to, do you require proof that they do have net worth of X amount, that they do have X amount of net income, 200 or 300,000 with a spouse? Is that important to do also, prove it, submit a tax return, for example?
No, actually, the typical approach is you may reasonably rely on the potential investors' answers to the questions in the Form D.
But you as an attorney would guide people through your consulting advice how to do this, what the questionnaire is, give it to them, I suspect, help them prepare it. That's why you're so important.
Yes, well, it can mean that the company will probably fail unless securities law compliance is achieved.
Very important. Now, another question. I think we have 2 minutes left before our next break. Can you have a mix between accredited investors and non-accredited investors in the same offering?
That does happen, but if you have any unaccredited investor, then the disclosure has to meet that required in Regulation A of the SEC or in Part 1 of a registration statement, and that means
heavy.
Basically
that's called
a
heavy,
full-blown
right?
prospectus.
That's huge, right?
And it's expensive.
That's got to be. And a full-blown prospectus in a minute or less would be what? Would that be, financial statements, of course, prepared by, I suspect, a CPA firm.
Well, you would address all of the material elements associated with the company, like the business plan.
Yeah.
Most of the information in the business plan can be dropped into the private placement memorandum.
Yeah.
You would want to address what competition there is and so forth.
Well, when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Bob Hackett from Reitnauer, Heitken & Lewis. We're talking about securities law, securities regulation, a very important topic if you are thinking of getting investors, I should say, and we'll be right back.
This is 1010 KXXT.
Are you suffering from pain in joints, whether from arthritis, osteoporosis, stiffness, or old sports injuries? You can be pain-free with BioVax and Joint Free. Don't settle for pain. Call 800-288-1961. That's 800-288-1961. BioVax and Joint Free comes in a 100% delicious natural liquid, which gives you the highest absorption versus generic pill forms with low absorption rate. Because of its quadruple action ingredients, many people experience pain-free results within 48 hours. BioVax and Joint Free increases joint mobility, decreases joint stiffness, and nourishes your joints with the highest grade glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM, hyaluronic acid, and all of your essential minerals and amino acids. Restore your joints, save your bones. Without mobility, we have no life. Conquer your pain once and for all. Call now for your free bottle when you get to. Call BioVaxine at 800-288-1961. That's 800-288-1961.
Hi, I'm Josh Rubel with Dwellings Realty Group. Is your home underwater? Are you considering or have you already missed a mortgage payment? Do you have questions about the options, the differences between a short sale and a foreclosure? If so, I strongly encourage you to call Dwellings Realty Group today at 480-629-8136. Dwellings Realty Group is a locally owned, full-service real estate brokerage that specializes in educating our clients in short sales, loan workouts, foreclosures, and additional options that may be available to you based on your individual circumstances. You owe it to yourself to call today for a free consultation and let us walk you through the best option that's available for you in regards to your home so that you may rest easy tonight. Call me, Josh Rubel, at 480-629-8136. You can also visit us on the web at dwellingsaz.com. Like the great Kenny Rogers said,
you got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up.
on the web at familyvaluesradio.net. This is 1010 KXXT.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Law Talk, sponsored by Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis. And in-studio guest from Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is Bob Hackett. And Bob, we've been talking about very important topics, especially if you're in business and you want to raise money, securities law, securities regulation, and you want to go into what listeners definitely want to know about but we're afraid to ask.
Well, typically, we advise that the company hire the professionals.
Oh, yeah.
Accountants, investment banker, securities counsel. The management should ask the professionals, including especially a reputable investment banker licensed as a broker-dealer, whether the offering should proceed, and if so, whether the market will likely purchase the securities. You have to structure the type of security which will appeal to investors. So, for example, the company could issue common stock, which can be either voting or non-voting, preferred stock, debentures, bonds, convertible notes, convertible preferred stock convertible into common, and in every one of those circumstances, you need to counsel the client regarding warrants to be issued to the investors, if any. Note that preferred stock should be authorized in the company's charter to be issuable in series by the board, which avoids the need for shareholder approval and a possible delay in the timing of the offering. And that is known as blank check preferred stock. And warrants are often used to sweeten the deal for investors. Note also that intellectual property counsel should be sure to protect any valuable IP through patents and trademark filings where appropriate. Then the next step in getting ready to raise capital is to have the accountants actually prepare the financial statements. The third step is for the company to prepare a business plan with pro forma financial statements that look forward, that are appropriately qualified.
And now, let me ask you this. Preparing the financial statements, is that supposed to be an audit, certified audit by a CPA?
Well, preferably an audit should be conducted.
But it's not required, you don't think?
It can be, depending upon which route you're going to take through the exemption information and materials. But definitely from a protective standpoint, I think a securities lawyer would want to have audited financial statements. And you should attach risk factors so that the investors understand that there is risk here and set forth the assumptions upon which the projections are based for the protection of the company and its control persons. Now, if the reaction from the professionals is positive, then counsel should prepare the documents for the offering. And if the offering is not exempt from registration under the federal and state securities laws, counsel should prepare a registration statement that includes a preliminary prospectus and file the registration statement with the SEC and the state securities commissions in the states in which the offering is to be made. When the regulators have commented on the preliminary prospectus and those comments have been addressed by counsel, then the final prospectus may be circulated to the prospective purchasers of the securities. On the other hand, if the securities offering is exempt from registration under applicable federal and state securities regulations, a disclosure document prepared by securities counsel that is usually called an offering memorandum should be delivered to their prospective investors to reduce risk of the company and its control persons to liability under the securities laws. In either event, whether it's exempt or non-exempt, the anti-fraud prohibitions in the federal securities regulations and under the state securities laws are applicable. So the issuer, through securities counsel, should be sure that the disclosure is not misleading, doesn't misstate or omit any material fact upon which the investor is to rely, and provide a fair summary of the facts and circumstances. Now, if a public offering is involved, then you should list the securities on a stock exchange by filing an application with the exchange, whether it's the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, over-the-counter markets, or regional stock exchanges. Then you need to put in place, in connection with a private offering, you have to contract with a private placement agent to cover the compensation, and that agent would receive compensation payable at closing to the placement agent. In a public offering, you would contract, the issuer would contract with the lead underwriter, and that's called the underwriter's agreement, and then at least in large public offerings, the lead underwriter will then enter into a contract with the members of the selling group. Let me just mention that corporate governance plays a larger and larger role in connection with corporate and securities practice. And I want to mention that the members of the board of directors owe a fiduciary duty to the shareholders. And that is broken down into basically three subjects. I'm going to just skim over the top of this due to time. But the directors owe a duty of loyalty to the shareholders. The directors owe a duty of due care, which means that the directors have to be satisfied through due diligence that the transaction is in the best interests of the shareholders. And thirdly, and most importantly, a director with a financial interest in the transaction should recuse himself from voting on the transaction when the transaction comes before the board. Two other noteworthy subjects that I'll just mention in passing. The company's board of directors may be staggered so as to deter a hostile takeover bid after a public offering. A staggered board is a board where the incumbent directors up for re-election don't constitute a majority of the members of the board. So, for example, a company with 9 directors with only 3 directors elected at each annual meeting of the shareholders. In the case of a hostile bid for a public company. In addition, the question arises, should the company have a poison pill, which I'll describe in just a moment. But there is a recent Delaware decision that recently affirmed the validity of a poison pill in a hostile bid setting. A poison pill, Dave, triggers when a hostile bidder attempts to take over a public company without the board of directors of the target company approving the bid. That's why it's called a hostile bid.
Well, Ken, how do they do that?
Let me just finish.
Sure.
When the trigger occurs, the shareholders of the target company receive substantial additional shares of the target company at a nominal price sufficient to defeat the approval of the hostile bid at the shareholders' meeting. So those are three very important areas in our corporate and securities practice.
That's amazing. So let's there's a couple things I want to go back to maybe clarify a few things. Like it says the members of the board of directors owe a fiduciary duty to the shareholders. That always makes sense. One, it says a duty of loyalty of directors to shareholders. How do you define that? I mean, what do they mean by loyalty?
Well, it's a very subjective test. But where the director, a board of directors, is not doing what's in the best interest of the shareholders, oftentimes the courts suggest that there was a breach of the duty of loyalty to the shareholders, and there's ample case authority which is beyond the scope of our discussion today,
right,
regarding what that means. The duty of due care is
you read my mind. That
equally
was
important.
Yeah.
And there the directors must be satisfied through due diligence that transaction is in the best interest of the shareholders. So, I mean, going to the country club and having a half an hour meeting on whether to sell the company or not, and then going out to play golf or any other sport is problematic.
That could be a problem. And then, so the criteria of duty of due care, that means, like you said, due diligence, and best practices would dictate that. So,
well, in this case, and I'm that's an excellent point, and in this case, I think we ought to just spend a few seconds describing what who's going to direct this due diligence. And basically, if you have a company and it's worth a lot of money and it's publicly held, I mean, you're going to want to engage an investment banking firm to come in and tell the board, is the price fair? If the price isn't fair, that's the end of the discussion.
Right.
Even if the price is fair, there may be other complications that the investment banker would point out to the board. And the investment banker's job is to counsel the board on whether to go through the with the transaction or not. Boards of directors really ought to focus on the selection of an investment banking company and the selection of counsel regarding whether there are any legal pitfalls that ought to come to the attention of the board.
Well, is the investment banker's only one that will counsel the board, or would you as an attorney be there as well?
Well, we counsel on legal matters. Sure, we're influenced by business circumstances, but it's really the investment banker's job to not only study this, but to issue a fairness letter indicate that the board can use to defend itself if it's attacked by a minority shareholder, that the price is fair to the shareholders.
And
if it isn't, if they can't say that, then the board has to consider withdrawing from the merger transaction.
I gotcha. I suspect being on the board of directors, there's some liability to them if they do not do their own due diligence.
The cases in this area suggest that you're absolutely right. There can be substantial liability for directors who breach their fiduciary duty to the shareholders.
So it's not just a matter of
and of course that applies not just to public companies but to private companies.
So be careful when you're asked to be on the board of directors. You know, it's not just a piece of cake. You really have to take it seriously.
Well, you
right?
do want to make sure that there is directors and officers liability insurance.
That's important,
and that
right?
the premiums on that should be paid by the company. And if that isn't available, then watch out.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And what would it mean if it's not available?
If it isn't available, then counsel ought to really ask, well, you know, why isn't it available?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it because
up?
The
yeah.
insurance company's premium is unfair, or is it because there's something wrong with the company?
You know, that's very good point. And when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Bob Hackett from Reitenauer, Heighton & Lewis. We're talking about securities regulation. This is a very complex topic. And when we come back, I'm going to ask a couple questions, maybe some basic definitions, like what is a security? People may want to know what that is, and we'll be right back.
What if your house is on fire, you call 911? The firemen don't know what to do, the truck's got a flat tire, the water hose has a leak, they can't decide what to wear, and everybody wants to drive the truck. This never happens because they have a process, they follow it, they're on the same page. I'll help you put your fires out with a business process. I'm Barbara Haggerty, helping you mind your own business. 602-750-4518. Increase the bottom line now. Even a two-person business needs a process, and I specialize in small business. 602-750-4518.
Weidenauer, Heighton & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heighton & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Law Talk every second Monday from 2 to 3, sponsored by Reitenauer, Heighton & Lewis. By the way, what a great firm this is, Bob. We have Bob Hackett in studio, Reitenauer, Heighton & Lewis. I always do a shout-out. Definitely the best law firm I've ever seen. I've been a CPA like 30 years, and man, they are a phenomenal firm. Also, a shout out for Carol. I always say this, the receptionist, she is amazing.
She is amazing, and we pride ourselves on the quality of our work, and we have a lot of great clients, and I think that makes for a good law firm.
There's no doubt, and it's not just technical excellence. But you guys are so fair and human and service-oriented. I could go on and on. You guys are great. Unbelievable stuff.
Well, you now haven't worked with me yet.
Yeah, but you're blushing now. What's going on? We got Bob to blush. Well, a couple questions that I think listeners will want to know regarding security regulation. First of all, the most basic, what is a security? A lot of people will say, well, I know what insecurity means, but that's psychological stuff. What is a security?
We'll put insecurity to
the
side.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
The term security means any note, stock, treasury stock, bond, debenture, evidence of indebtedness, certificate of interest or participation in any profit-sharing agreement, and so forth and so on. Now,
are you saying a profit sharing agreement?
Profit sharing agreement.
So that's like a profit's interest maybe in a partnership?
Yes.
And so let me ask you this, because I see this all the time. So if someone's cutting a deal with just two people trying to form a partnership, and one wants some type of profit's interest, do they have to do anything about that?
Well, if each of them is participating actively in the business, and that's usually the case with two entrepreneurs,
right?
They're not relying on the efforts of others.
Okay, so the key is if they're
relying on themselves
to make
a profit.
Okay,
so that's okay.
But if you give a profit's interest to someone based on just some type of arrangement, someone putting money in and say, we'll cut you, you know, a profit's interest, that's a security, you're saying?
Well, if it falls within one of those definitions.
Gotcha.
But let me just mention that there's a conflict between the federal interpretation of what a note is and the state of Arizona test. The federal courts have held that a note, as defined in the 33 Act, that's like a promissory note that I would give to a bank to borrow some money, is not a security.
For the SEC?
For purposes of the 33 Act.
Right.
On the other hand, issuing IOUs to 1,000 people is going to raise eyebrows. Because those are investments.
Gotcha.
And the most famous decision on investment contract is SEC v. Howey. And in SEC v. Howey, the investors were relying solely on the efforts of the promoter manager of these citrus groves to make a profit for them. And the court held that that those types of undivided interests in the citrus groves were investment contracts and therefore securities. So everyone knows that stock is a security under the securities laws, but there can be some interesting interpretations that go on in the judicial systems regarding what is and what is not an investment contract.
That's interesting. So there's a lot of hidden things here, not really hidden, but things that people may consider, hey, this isn't a security, but it may be, and you better be aware. That's why you always should have an attorney, just to have an attorney anyway.
I think that's good advice.
Yeah.
There is a lot of pressure on the part of entrepreneurs and others take a look back, for the SEC to take a look back at what it has done in terms of capital formation. And so I wanted to mention that Mary Shapiro, the chairman of the commission, has ordered a review of all of the rules and regulations affecting smaller businesses. And this is particularly important given the cost of securities compliance work. So I just thought I would mention that the Wall Street Journal has an excellent article Friday, April 8, entitled USI's New Stock Rules, and this is page one, front cover. The subject is Regulators Move Toward Relaxing Limits on Shareholders in Private Companies. If you have a company that has less than 500 shareholders, you're not subject to those draconian 34 Act reports, the 10K, the 10Qs, the 8Ks. But there's a segment of the investment community that says that 500 number ought to be increased in order to reduce the burden of complying with all of those forms.
Because it's expensive, isn't it?
It's very expensive. And let me just quote from that article. The review also will examine issues raised by the growing use of special purpose vehicles that allow a pool of investors to buy a stake in a company while counting as only one shareholder for the purposes of the SEC rules. So that is going to be considered. There were two other articles I found in the Wall Street Journal that your listeners might be interested in that appeared, I believe, on the following Monday. And the captions are Small Internet Sales of Stock Get Review. And that emphasizes that the SEC should not make the rules so flexible that fraudsters will be benefited.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
And then another article under the caption "Intelligent Investor: The Next Google or the Next Debacle," talks about looking for a winner in the shadows. So this area is getting a lot of attention, and it's a very important area for Arizona, because we want to grow good companies with excellent management, terrific boards of directors, and that's the best way to move our economy forward. And this review by the SEC hopefully will address the concerns that were expressed in these Wall Street Journal articles.
So they're trying to, or are they looking to loosen up the rules a little bit? So or is it making it tougher?
Well, that hasn't been decided yet.
Yeah.
These articles are within the last few days. The review is supposed to have been undertaken already, and we'll just have to see what the commission comes up with.
Yeah, this is interesting, especially if it raises the threshold for, you said, less than 500 shareholders not subject to some of these reporting.
The 34 Act reporting.
Yeah. No. So if you raise it, then it will include a lot more people, companies, not to have to report these things, like the 10Q.
It would really be a matter of avoiding the cost of,
right,
of compliance under the 34 Act.
So I wonder if that would create more problems.
If there were higher, if that number 500
right,
were increased.
Wow. So what would that do to your practice? Would that change things a little
bit? Well, anything that's good for capital, responsible capital formation, is good for us.
Well, that makes
we
sense.
Want our companies, our corporate clients to succeed.
Yeah. You don't want another Enrons, right?
We don't.
No.
We want to avoid that.
And Arthur
at all costs.
Arthur Andersen knows well about that.
Yes, they do, unfortunately.
That was really unfortunate. I was shocked when that happened, actually. I guess maybe I wasn't that shocked. But it is shocking when you see a CPA firm as big as Arthur Andersen. I think they were number one go down because of that, or among other things, too. But I think the government said they can't do certified audits anymore, and that really sort of killed it right there.
That was the death penalty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
I had friends there, and they've moved on to other accounting firms. But to see that accounting firm fail was
that's huge.
Pretty sobering.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's no question. And I think what we have about a minute or two left, perhaps. We got 2 minutes. Maybe a summary comment about this, and I'd like to ask in 1 minute or less, again, to reemphasize that if you're going to start to raise capital, don't do it without advice.
Well, I think that point has been made, so I think your listeners are aware of that now, we're there to help our corporate clients. So I think it's been a real pleasure being with you today, Dave.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an honor because it's rare you meet an attorney in this specialty. I don't think there's a whole lot of attorneys that I've seen over the years that have this type of specialty, and congratulations to you for having so much wisdom and knowledge in this area.
Well, I had some good teachers.
Oh, see, that's always important to have good teachers. How about some contact information? How do they get in touch with you?
Sure. Our phone number is 602-254-9900. Our fax is 602-254-8670. And my email address is rjhackett@rhkl-law.com.
And it's well worth it. People should just say hi to you. I mean, well, you're probably pretty busy, but I've always said it. If you need, you know, the time to get an attorney is when you don't need one. You should establish a relationship, and when something comes up, at least you know the client. And that's how I always tell my clients, at least establish a relationship, at least with the firm. And you have so many specialties. It's a great firm. And again, if you want to contact Reitner or Hyten & Lewis, it's 602-254-9900, 602-254-9900. It's well worth it. And thank you so much, Bob Hackett, for joining us today on Law Talk.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Absolutely. We'll have you back soon. And stay tuned for Understanding Autism right away at 3 o'clock. We'll be right back.